Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Ann Sano. Ann Sano was born and raised in California and moved to Saudi Arabia for 2 years following high school graduation. Her stories have appeared in Kenyon Review, Shenandoah, Crab Orchard Review, and Malahat Review, among other publications. She has been nominated 4 times for the Pushcart Prize. She is the winner of the Drew Heinz Literature Award and will be reading tonight from her story collection, Triple Time. She also just recently won the Nelson Algren Award from the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Ann. Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you.
How about you start off tonight by reading a little bit from Triple Time?
All right. This is from what I think of as the opening to the title story. The title's actually Slow Stately Dance in Triple Time. And the beginning of that is Looping the Loop, 1946. It was nothing like diving over the chalk cliffs from Folkestone to Dover, where sun dappled the ocean below and sent up a glare that could stun a man into going the wrong direction. He'd managed to be in the thick of it mostly on bright days, only once or twice chasing Messerschmitts in the fog that he'd been told would never let up. As a matter of fact, that was simply not true, like other places one is told about. Of the Arabian Desert, others like him had certainly come before, but of the words written about it, Gus was ignorant. Driving the plane into the sharpest, sheerest blue sky he'd seen since a boy, he saw below what he had not been able to fully imagine when standing in its midst. There was a name for every ridge, every dune. As Gus caught an updraft, preparing to whip over and down, he could hear Basim shouting from the passenger seat in front of him. The machine was old, a late model biplane. If there had once been a gun rig, there was no longer any trace of it. Falling into the downdraft, the two men saw the sands gleaming like waves. They rippled and broke, and Gus could figure, without having to hear Basim's explanations, the patterns made by the shifting winds. It was a map. Gus took the nose higher for one last flip. Then they looked down at sky, up at land. And after the horizons righted themselves again, their goggles continued to defy gravity, remaining on their foreheads. Gus dropped the plane into a lazy spiral, the world from 5,000 feet becoming closer and real again, slowly, then faster, then slower still. Back on the ground, taxiing short in the tugging sand, the colors and lines of the landscape and the objects there were distinct. There were tents, jeeps, camels, men. That morning, Gus had at first failed to discern the plane itself, sitting parked, which, like everything else, seemed to blend into an endless beige. Now he was blinded as if by a rainbow. When Basim climbed out of his seat and asked him if he'd understood, Gus was startled by the bronze hue of his friend's face. Then he said that he hadn't been able to hear much through the wind. "But you understand," Basim said, clasping him by the shoulders and looking at him carefully. "Well, yes," Gus said, "he did." Basim bin Fadl al-Aben was the son of long traditions, and he knew that no man like Gus, no parched plain roaming Texan boy, would ever read the desert as well as he could himself. And his own skills, though valid, were something he'd seemed determined to shuck off. This lack of seriousness drove his father to a state of suspended grief. What good was it for Basim to have this Bedou knowledge in his blood if he squandered it on airplanes and automobiles and sporting with hawks? Why these things? It was talent wasted without care. In Naples, Gus had learned these particulars from Basim. They talked about fathers as a way of introduction. Gus had been released from service, he said, and he was not inclined to return home. He and his new friend took in the cities of North Africa and the Mediterranean, and for a time, the fascination of shoddy cafes and winding alleys was enough. Remember, his war had been from the air. What he understood was the bird's eye view, a shoulder of coastline, a grid of city or town shot over. Grounded now, he had already wandered. With Basim, it was no longer desultory. "It's not Texas," Gus said. In return for Basim's stories about the desert, he described the dry terrain and ranch lands 40 miles south of Abilene. He'd been relieved to get away from that flat, stretched place where the dirt smelled sour and his people let the landscape win. His tale soon ran out. He couldn't compete. Basim wound digressions into his narratives, taking up afternoons while they sat drinking coffee at tables on the streets next to other young men of various background and nationality. Talk of battles was winding down. There was only so much repetition to be wrung from them. Gus and Basim reached a high pitch in their restlessness, a state that surpassed even that of the others strewn among the conjoining continents in that first year after the war. They were surprised at how quickly people were getting on. There was a drifting back and then a tightening. What did you do? Who are you? What do you want? Where 2 months earlier they had slipped through with little notice, Basim, after all, might be Indian with his excellent lilting English, it was clear that despair on a grand scale did not exhaust suspicion. They continued south. In Cairo, the effects of unsettling were vibrant. Here were skins of all colors and different uniforms, many pilfered or inauthentic. The two young men could breathe. Basim knew the city well, having attended its university. They could certainly have gone to the auberge. Basim had afforded it during his student days and talked of the dancing and the stages and crystal-lit waterfalls and pools. But instead, he directed them to a neighborhood where the doorways were low and heavy curtains fell across the archways. He lifted one of these, and Gus looked down into a cellar room with a dozen or so small tables crowded together where men sat and watched a dancer thrash her hips to a drumbeat and cymbals. The lanterns hooked to the wall gave off a sickly light, and the girl's eyes glittered like a lizard's. So this is how it's supposed to be, Gus must have thought, and he was depressed. Turning back to the door, he saw that Basim had dropped the curtain and disappeared. The next day, Basim suddenly pitched his coffee out of its cup onto the stone floor of the establishment where they were sitting. "This is swill," he said, loud enough for the barman to hear. Gus understood that this unusually rude display meant that it was time they moved on. From the port at the Red Sea, Basim hired 3 men to drive them as far as the good roads went out to the Nejd Plateau. From there, they would find the family. 2 weeks, or a little more. The trip would have taken that long then. Sleeping in tents when the sun was high, making their way from village to well to date palm grove at night. It was new to Gus, so they did not hurry and stayed in places where Basim's father was known. Fadl bin Salah al-Aban's son could expect hospitality. Much later, it was suggested that this journey could have been the beginning of something else. At the time, it was expected only that Basim was coming home. The two young men paraded themselves into camp in midsummer, each behind the wheel of a jeep, and their arrival was viewed with indulgence to be absorbed seamlessly into the life there that would go on as it had.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Anne Sano, winner of the Drew Heinz Literature Award, reading from her story collection, Triple Time. And when I was reading your stories, one of the things I was thinking, there's kind of these echoes of transience and endurance and permanence throughout. And I think, of course, the landscape kind of pushes those resonances up. And I know that, you know, by your bio, you lived in Saudi Arabia for a couple of years. But I'm wondering, you know, in then writing about it later, was there a way that you learned something new about those kind of movements and permanence that maybe you weren't aware of at the time that you were actually doing it yourself?
Right. Absolutely. First of all, I went there at the age of 17. And one of the stories in the book called The Date Farm is about the experience of a young expatriate woman arriving in this country, not really knowing what to do with herself and finding herself very restricted. That's as close to autobiography as it comes. When you successfully do a story like that, and I should say it took me many years to do that successfully, And as a writer, I needed to do something else. I would be bored if I were just writing about the same sort of thing, the same experience.
Right.
And I was really intrigued enough by what I saw. I did get out into the desert. I did get out in the city. I explored a lot while I was there, of really getting underneath as much as I could as a writer. And so I started – sometimes I just asked questions like, what if? What if a young woman didn't want to leave the country? You know, what if she only knew Saudi Arabia as her home? I developed another character named Kimberly because of that, and she's someone who appears in several stories and makes perhaps what we would consider to be an unusual choice. and I was also just – I've always been historically intrigued by journeys and legends and history, and so I started reading things like the parts of the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, T. E. Lawrence, Wilfred Thesiger's desert exploration journals. Mm-hmm. Where I learned some things like what kind of lizard you would eat if you needed to.
In case you're hungry and you're in the desert.
It's a dub lizard. And one of the characters here catches – Gus catches one in one of the stories. You can also take camel's milk and it can be dried into shards and kept in pouches. And you can exist on that as food if you need to. So I'm a writer who loves research.
Yeah.
So I love it. And any project I work on, it has a research component. It's like going back to school with no grades, no papers. Yeah.
But, one of the things that I noticed, and, this is just from my point of view, but it seemed to me that some of this kind of fluidity, the landscape obviously is always changing because it's sand and it's shifting. Not all of it. I mean, there are cities in your stories as well. But I started noticing it in the structure of your stories.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they start moving in one direction. Sometimes you even shift the characters, and then by the end, it starts shifting into another direction, and you haven't left behind the question that was opened in the story, but you aren't necessarily interested in answering it directly.
I'm not actually. Another writer friend of mine says that I wander in my stories, and I do. I suppose maybe there's just some instinct to do that. I also like to read stories of any kind, any length, where I, as a reader, have to sort of explore myself and learn something. Mm-hmm. I'm just not very intrigued by easy answers. And also in this culture and this country, there aren't easy answers.
Right. That's one of the things I will say I found really pleasurable about the book, because I think at times we get so used to what story structure is that you start to feel like a detective, that you're like, I think I can guess what the climax and the, epiphany is going to be. And your stories, it's not even consciously resisting it. They just don't really do that. They don't seem interested in that kind of work.
Yeah. I will frustrate a reader who wants, to see ahead in that way. But I am very conscious of these structures. I have to start visualizing a structure in my head. Then the story, the architecture starts to make sense to me. I tend to see it as a big arc with a lot of threads, sort of winding, through. And I am conscious of things that maybe echo somewhere else. That I try to pick up again, maybe not always successfully, but you try.
Sure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Ann Sano, winner of the Drew Hines Literature Award, reading from her story collection, Triple Time. Ann, could you read a bit more?
Sure. I'm going to read a small clip from the final story in the book called Rub al-Khali. Rub al-Khali is the name of the empty quarter. So that's the desert that takes up most of the country. The narrator is Thoreia, who in this story is a modern matriarch dealing with some family problems. I should say she was a 12-year-old Bedouin girl with a one-line walk-on, and she would not stop talking, so she got her own story. but here she has just spoken with her son, who is married to two women, one of them an American, and now she's in her high-rise. She was born in a tent. Now she's in a high-rise. I slide the door open and take a glass of tea out to the balcony. At sunset, the desert edges into the city. The sand is melon-tinged, and rays spill over roofs and water towers and bright blue swimming pools. Riyadh is beautiful like this. It is impossible for me to say how happy I am here. Sitting and watching, I feel young. It is my daughters-in-law, not my sons, who do not understand why I live in the towers. So modern, Kimberly has said. She remembers when they were built, after she came here as a girl, and a district of market stalls was obliterated. Of course, having the luxury, she imagines it a tragedy of progress. For Manar, the objection is one of space. She needs more to make her presence felt, and is always redecorating the girls' rooms or the big hexagon space off the kitchen where the women gather, or Talal's study. In my five rooms, she sees a condition of reduced circumstances. But my circumstances are not reduced. Here, in fact, here in this high gleaming tower, which throws its glare from the windows like a beacon, here there are worlds wound together with years. Like the balcony below mine, where skinny palms, their roots trapped in brass pots, nevertheless reach their fronds up to brush past the edges of the cement rectangle where I sit. It is a tiny oasis in the sky. Or two across and one up, the old man who naps outside on a rug each afternoon with his goat. The family in the penthouse increases each year. The wife swishes briskly through the lobby with glittering abayas tossed over her smart pantsuits, and she is trailed by a retinue of Filipino nannies who manage the growing brood with cell phones and date books and drivers. There is space enough for visitors if we want them, but also a containment if we do not. The towers are efficient. When I look over the city, I can see what is beyond, for the desert is never far, and when I move about my rooms, they are spare and orderly, each thing in its place, as I once made my thing so in a tent. And sometimes, like now, with the last ring of prayer fading away, it is quiet. This is what I am reduced to, and it opens wide.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Ann Sano, reading from her story collection, Triple Time, which won the Drew Heinz Literature Award. So one of the other things in reading your stories, Ann, you know, obviously you're a woman, but you're also writing about women from two very different cultures.
Right.
And so I wanted to ask you about the challenges of that so that it didn't just end up being kind of East versus West and, you know, historical versus
right.
contemporary.
Yeah. I was very – you know, I think it took a lot of years and a lot of, trust me, failed experiments. I'm a writer who fortunately will throw away a lot of drafts. Sometimes I think you just need to spend a lot of time with your characters and they do eventually start to talk to you. I can find some commonality with almost any female character, but from there, they have to assert themselves. I think as a writer, you have characters who just – you try them, they're flat, and then it doesn't matter where they're from. They're not interesting.
Right.
At a certain point, I think maybe I just had enough practice trying and failing better, you know, that I just decided to stop worrying about the sort of maybe authority that I did or did not have to write about, you know, Saudi women. The best thing I ever did was dare myself to jump into the first person voice of Thoreia. It was like a method writing experiment. It was like I kept saying, yeah, I can do this. I can do this. It's okay. I can find a way to understand her. And then she just, you know, became so strong that I just thought of her as a woman who was trying to assert her independence in her way.
Mm-hmm.
She's not here to instruct the reader on isms or something like that, you know?
Right.
And she's not instructing on East versus West.
Yeah, I guess I was just really noticing that, and I hadn't really thought about this before, even in my own writing, developing characters, of the characters who they may have great presence.
Right.
But they don't want to be in the foreground.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's something that I didn't really quite think of it that way, but that is actually interesting. She is, I think, a strong character, but she is still a matriarch. She does step back from her family and she does try to manage things, but she does seem to understand that, people have to sort of exercise their own judgments and their own opinions. Maybe that's why I like her.
Great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Anne Sano, reading from her collection Triple Time, which has won the Drew Heinz Literature Award. Anne, would you read a bit more?
Sure. This – I'm reading from a story called Safety, which is what I refer to as my women in prison story. Kimberly – this is my – Kimberly is a young expat woman who's just absolutely unlike my experience or unlike, you know, Jill, another character. She is – she's only really known this country as her home. She has a ne'er-do-well father. She's been around for other – you know, gone through all these stepmothers. So she's kind of a know-it-all. And I was trying – and her – I tried to get into her voice as, you know, somebody who maybe thinks she knows a little more than she does. So this is a brief section called Shopping. She says, on Tuesday, I walked down in the Albata Street souks looking for a funnel. You cannot walk into a hardware store in Riyadh and ask for one. They know why we want them, and they don't want to sell them to us. I could have just taken the supplies from my father. But when he is out of the country, my stepmother roams the house like a lost goat, flicking through fashion magazines and pacing between suntans and snacks, making me nervous. I make her nervous because she knows that she can do nothing to stop me when I find a way to go out. If you know where to go like I do, then you know that shopping between sundown and night prayers is the best time. Dusk blues the day's glare and what we wear doesn't stick. Head to feet. Wrapped up in my black, and I'm ready to slip through the crowds like an eel. I left the driver on the main road that no longer smells of the open sewer that ran there 15 years ago. The Albata Street Yacht Club was the joke. I've got an old T-shirt somewhere to commemorate it. Now it's a wide marble median strip, throwing off glittery winks at the stall windows where gold hangs in ropes. And behind this shiny facade are the places we go when we can't get something through by army post. Lingerie or French perfume, which might be taken at customs, or birth control pills and nitramin, which makes you wonder just who's really in charge here. And things like yeast, now banned from the supermarkets, and funnels and hoses for distilling our Siddiqui grain. If I could tell my friend Jane about it now, I'd say that of course I know you can't get caught. You pay attention. Cover yourself. This is no insult when you know better. Covering means hiding, and it's something to be good at, especially when you pique the interest of a red-bearded Matawain on the prowl for vice. And when the stakes seem meaningless, you're good at hiding. Naturally, when the stakes were high, I slipped up.
You mentioned earlier about being a writer who likes to draft and being willing to let those drafts go. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit just about putting a collection together like this one, which is kind of revisiting, you know, it's kind of like being part of a whole environment and then trying to pick out which stories to tell and what voice and who gets to tell them. So if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Originally, I knew I would write several stories about Saudi. I didn't know they'd be connected. Did not know that. What happened is that I think the date farm was the first story I did. Then I needed to get away from, you know, something close to my experience. Then I got to Kimberly, you know, the expat, you know, woman who's different. Then I went to the historical material, the big sort of, you know, thematic David Lean like, you know, desert exploration stories. Then Thorea came out. So now I had these three strong voices. I had Thorea, I had Kimberly, and then Gus, the mysterious World War II pilot, although he doesn't speak much. but he's a presence, you know. And so at that point, I just realized, wait a minute, as a writer, I want to experiment with, you know, sometimes third person, sometimes first. I don't want to write a novel, but these characters need more space. So some of those – the decision to link was organic at that point. You know, Thorea getting her own story was like a no-brainer. Writing the second part of Gus's big desert exploration also seemed natural. Then sometimes I had to find ways to link. You know, I had to insert Kimberly all of a sudden as a 10-year-old girl in another piece and as, you know, I think a 19-year-old girl in another piece. So some of those decisions were a little more strategic.
And then did you put the stories – like I'm sure you shuffled them around in – or maybe you didn't, just in terms of then
the
being
order.
Able to see, yeah, the stories in juxtaposition to each other, like how they took shape as a whole.
Yeah. I think I always you know, I started early drafts of the Slow Stately Dance in Triple Time story that, you know, what I think of as like sort of my big gay desert love centerpiece, you know, historical centerpiece. I always felt like that would be the center because it's more formal in tone, you know, maybe does a few more of those writer pyrotechnic types of things. And I think the title story is for some people difficult because it shifts points of view. And so I felt like the other things would come around that. You know, I ended up having the first person voices fall and the second half of the book. And then the decision to open the collection with Pioneer, which is that, you know, centered around a 9-year-old boy, just sort of clicked for me because I felt he was a non-judgmental way for readers to enter the world of Saudi Arabia, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And, you know, I think the story with the multiple points of view, the title story. Yeah. I mean, what's nice about that is it does, even though it's not the first story in the book, it feels like a kind of, you know, in Europe they call it the roundabout. It's it's that square that all the roads kind of come to.
Yeah, it's very much an anchor. I had fun as a writer doing that. It's a funny story because, well, this is where Thoreia starts to take over. You know, really, that's her story. She owns it. Those plural first person voices, they're hers. She owns this story. I don't. but I did feel like the threads sort of ended up there. And I wanted to give some sense of history and progress and, you know, those sorts of things.
So I guess I would ask about that then. Why did you leave it in plural first person? I mean, I guess, you know, that's a writer versus – not writer versus, writer with character choice. Like, why that choice?
Yeah, that – strangely, all of that was so very – it was working on instinct. It was not planned. You know, again, we mentioned drafts earlier, and I am a writer who, you know, I will allow myself to just sort of write pieces and sections without knowing what they're attached to. I really rarely start at the beginning and move straight through. I'm jealous of people who can do that. and that story, along with the Grand Tour, kind of its counterpart, were very much that way. It was 3 years of pieces, you know, descriptive parts. I knew they were somehow going to come together. I can't even quite remember when I took that shift and the girls started to talk and I just let them.
Well, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with your structure being willing to wander, as it were. So believe it or not, our time is up.
Wow. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio 91.3 WYEP.